We are in the beginning of a 14-part series. This is the second talk in the series of seven talks, 14 classes on the seven factors of enlightenment. And this particular factor that I wish to explore with you this evening is on investigation. And I want to, I want you to get into this talk, if I can encourage you to do that, because it's an essential tool for lay practitioners. I can't think of another talk that could mean as much as this one could potentially mean to people's Dharma practice. If you understand it, if you take it in, if you really energize yourself around it, it's essential if it's going to work for us, I think, in our culture, in our group, with the conditioned heaviness that we bring into our lives. And given the fact that we're not monastics, given the fact that we're not, most of us, doing extended and prolonged retreat. Does that mean in some way that we are a second-class meditator, a second-class Dharma student, and that we're destined for less than full awakening? Well, it's up to each one of us, as it is up to each one of the monks in their monastic tradition. But no, by no means does the environment, does the situation you're in, does the fullness of your life deter at all from that full awakening, which is what the seven factors of enlightenment is about. So, stay with me on this one. I think it's essential. The Buddha said we can do four things when we're in pain. Four things. We can do one of four things. We can do all of the four things, but mostly we do one of the four things. We blame others, right? You made me miserable. The weather made me miserable. My boss made me miserable. My spouse made me miserable. We know that one. We can blame ourselves. How can I not be miserable? I'm a miserable person. I'm no good. I can't do it. I'm on and on. Most of us know that one as well. The third thing we can do is despair and feel kind of hopeless, despondent, adrift. The fourth thing we can do, the Buddha said, is investigate. And he says, the only one of any merit is the last. Investigate. Now, I hope this talk challenges, because I mean it to, because I led off last week with the first factor of enlightenment, mindfulness. And I used a metaphor that I'm going to reuse, and that is that mindfulness, we're making a pot of soup. Well, we have to start out the soup with stock, right? The stock, the water, the fluid is the mindfulness. And then we add seasonings to the fluid to make it soup-like and tasty. And the rest of the six factors are the seasonings. Once they are stirred into the soup, they become part of the fluid itself. You can't extract one of the taste from the fluid once it's completely melted in. And so we're not trying to separate out these factors as individual piecemeal approaches to our spiritual journey, but rather to give that particular factor a taste factor. We can say, okay, let's see if I can taste the basil in this soup. Let me see if I can taste the thyme. Let me see if I can taste the salt. And you can by arousing that particular attention to the taste. So, too, we are now beginning to add a spice to this thing. Remember what makes the soup boil. The stock, the The seasonings do not do that. What does so is the fire underneath. The fire underneath is an intangible that is not included within the seven factors. It is simply your sincerity, your intention for life, and how you want to use life. That's what cooks the soup. And so when we look at whether this particular situation that we're in, as opposed to a monk in a monastic tradition, is less meaningful spiritually, how hot is the fire under you? That's what's going to determine whether the soup cooks or not. So this question, now this aspect of investigation, once we have the soup stock, mindfulness does wonders, doesn't it? It turns on the light in the room. It's amazing, really. And we can begin to see, but that's not sufficient, because it doesn't bring mindfulness in and of itself, doesn't bring sufficient energy or interest or probing to allow things to be discovered. Those are contained within the rest of the seasoning within that soup. It's not just good enough to turn on the light. We now have to uncover, see, look, probe with interest, which is another factor of enlightenment, to see what's there, to see where we're being fixed, to see where we're being held, to see where we're being, we're assuming a certain features, and to look at the assumptions that we're making when the light is turned on. I can turn the light on and make the same assumptions that I had when I had the light off. Nothing's changed, really. Me and you, this and that, the problems of my life, I just have the light on. Doesn't mean I'm going to look at all, really. That's where investigation comes in. I think investigation hasn't been given a critical enough emphasis in this tradition. And I think we're used to having a problem and just kind of mindfully holding the problem within the light. We're, say, judging. Yes, I'm judging. I know I'm judging. Judging. Have you ever noticed that nothing really happens to the judgment? It may dissipate from your ability to attend, but it comes back equally as emphatically later on. It doesn't seem to have, it doesn't seem to be uprooted in any way just by noticing and noting, judging, because that isn't sufficient. We have to go in there and look and to see what it is that we're getting from the judgment, how it is that the mind is working to posture itself in terms of judgment. What is its assumptions from judgment? What is its psychic position when judgment occurs? What is it attempting to do when it judges? All of those things are immediately obvious. They are not analytical or intellectual pursuits. They are there within the judgment. But if we spend our time just looking outward at the fact that judgment is occurring, we'll never look at the source and the motivation for why judgment is arising at all. Now, this isn't a talk on judgment, but I'm just using that as an example for how investigation uproots, doesn't just assume life is what it is and the fact of judgment is just a fact and I might as well get on with my fact by just noticing that it's occurring. It's not sufficient. It's not usually sufficient just to notice that we have an emotion arising. It's essential that we do notice emotion arising. But what's the posture that we have with that emotion? Why are we feeding it? What are we getting from it? You see, now you have to, when I start speaking in this way, this is obviously an energy arousing factor. And I'm carrying forth that energy arousing quality in myself. Now, when I speak about that, we have to be interested in there. That's another factor of enlightenment. The interest itself is a factor outside of mindfulness. But you can see how it brings kind of a critical aspect to the meditation. It shakes us. It has a stretch beyond our normal and usual understanding of what meditation is. It has a stretch upward. And that is a key to investigation. Investigation breaks apart the habitual patterns and assumptions of the way we see. I was speaking to a long-term meditator right prior to beginning this class tonight, and she was talking about how she has fallen from time to time into the slumps of habituation in her practice. And then she'll listen to a new voice, and that new voice will uplift her for a while until there's a new slump, an energetic slump, and you know the voice, you know what the voice is saying, you know what it has said, you have looked and been excited about this new perception, but then there's the inevitable letdown as those words take on a conditioned reference and nothing new is then seen thereafter. Oh, I know that. I've heard that from him before. And then you either leave the fold and go off to try to find some other voice that will arouse that energy to get you excited again, to get you energized, or you will stay within the slumber and just assume that that's just the way the meditation is that kind of slumbered reference from one thing to another. It's not. This is, we are a light. What does aliveness mean? It doesn't mean slumbering our way to aliveness. It means using the very means of aliveness to wake ourselves up. And investigation keeps us on our edge, breaks apart the crystallization, the frozen quality that begins to entrap us inevitably when we assume we know, when we assume we've heard that before, when things aren't heard fresh but heard from the conscious memory, repetitious memory. There are only a certain number of words that describe the Dharma. I mean, there isn't a lot. There are 10,000 different ways to say it, but it's all kind of saying the same thing. How are we going to keep ourselves alive in this? How are we going to stretch ourselves up? And I think that is a melody. It's a malaise of the older, more experienced student. They don't know how to keep themselves alive within this. Because there's a way that our lives start folding around and become comfortable and become habituated within that comfort. And the mind loves the security of thinking that it's using a spiritual path and it's on a journey to break out of this cocoon of entrapment. Yet it stays entrapped energetically and not, it doesn't offer the energetic attempt to get out of the entrapment. It stays within this cocoon, just thinking, okay, if I just keep doing this, you know, everything will unfold just from the doing. No, it requires much more from you. It's not a passive activity. You can't just sit back and say, okay, you know, it's not that. It requires an enormous energetic arousing and willing to face anything that comes on, because you realize that if you don't, you'll soon be entrapped by that very thing. It's a matter of time, no matter where our understanding is. So that understanding becomes an island that cuts you off from any further journey. And so investigation is an attempt to arouse that energy, to break out of the patterns that have frozen us and separated us out. It breaks us out of our fixation, our fixed response to ourself, and our fixed understanding to the Dharma. There is no fixed position that is a wakeful position. There is no fixed position. There is no fixed understanding that is the awakened understanding. And if you find yourself therein, then you need to stretch out of that because you're trapped. and your assumption from that point of view. Spiritual journey is not a formula. It's, how could it be a formula? If I just sit and walk, sit and walk, sit and walk, sit, you know, and the progression of my insight will unfold, and all I have to do is just sit and walk, sit and walk, and sit, that the whole thing... No. That's much too passive. Where are you hiding? Where do you not want to be known? Where are you so closeted that not even your own awareness wants to enter? And where is the courage in you to face that area? To open that closet door, because that's what's required. Not sitting, walking, sit. And that can be done off the cushion, perhaps more easily than it can be on the cushion. Because when you're on the cushion and on retreat, you think you have a system. You think you have a formula for the ending of your sorrow. There's a schedule, sit, walk, sit, walk, sit. Where's the critical factor in that? Where's the torch? Where's the hard question? You see how important this topic is? I'm not playing this one. This one's no play on this one. When I was in Thailand, I was so sick of people telling me. I had spent 4 years in at IMS in Barrie, first long-term yogi, practicing endlessly. And I went to Thailand. I said, I don't want to hear anyone tell me anything anymore. I'm so filled with Dharma raps, so filled with what other people have to say about Dharma, that I can't. I was overflowing. Nothing else could get in. And then I said, I'm taking this thing apart myself. I'm going to find out for myself. And I don't know where the arising of the investigative energy came from. It came from the pangs of the heart. That's where it comes from. And when you know your position and you've heard the words, but you're not living the word, and the words don't get in anymore because you've heard them, and you've become just shut off from their true meaning, their vitality, their aliveness. So for the next 4 years, I cleared the table and I brought out each Dharma phrase, and I didn't part with that Dharma phrase until I saw it and knew it for myself, and would not move from it until I, you know, other people would tell me, you know, I would have this, like, just having a tremendous interest in, I would read something and I'd say, come to the word ignorance. What is ignorance? And hearing, you know, I would say, what is ignorance? You want to know what ignorance is when it grabs you that way. What is ignorance? What is it? If I can't see it, you know, I'll never be able to understand it. And then having people who come to the monastery, various, you know, talk to you about ignorance, and I didn't want to hear it. I didn't want you shut up. I don't want to hear what your explanation of it is. That nothing would that it just it was not sufficient at all. The intellectual attempt to arouse. Attempt to satisfy that heart's need, the heart's pounding. Not until you see it. Oh, of course. Now, this factor of enlightenment, I think, it's my own interpretation, is what the Buddha meant by the fourth foundation of mindfulness, uncovering the Dharma. Uncovering the Dharma. Because it can become a way of life. And you can, it necessitates awareness accompanying it. You can't ask a question in which the purpose and point of that investigation is to see without the light being turned on, so that you can see. So it accompanies mindfulness. I find it a way to arouse mindfulness. And I often arouse the mindfulness through the curiosity. So my door into all of the seven factors coming together is that question. And how does that question arise? When I'm in pain. When I feel that there is some rub. What's going on here? That's not a question of safety. We ask a question from insecurity. You are cast out now. You cannot assume the home environment and safety of an intellectual answer. We are cast out on our own when we ask an important, pertinent question, like, what is this? What's going on? We're not looking for a resolution that intellectually satisfies. We're casting out. We're looking dynamically. And we're willing to go into free fall. Because when we cast out a when we cast a question out, we can no longer hold the position from which the question was asked. When I feel in pain and I say, what is this? I cannot maintain the sense that I am a person in pain. Or it cannot be investigated. You see that? You can't investigate from the position. You have to let the position go. Everything's open now to looking. What is this? What's going on? It's like being on a jungle gym. You know, the bars that you... And you let go of one bar, but before you grab the other bar, there's this moment in which the unsafety and the fear element, before the grasping on the next bar and the release of the former bar, that state of not knowing, you see, is itself, that's itself the question. The question brings us to that state of not knowing. So do you see how the question itself is the practice? But we have to be willing to put ourselves in free fall. We have to be willing to eliminate all forms of security. Because that's what a question will do. Said differently, we have lost all forms of control. All control. So that's why a question is so difficult. That's why we want an intellectual answer. An intellectual answer is the next rung on the jungle gym. Now I know. And we want to go from rung to rung. And we don't want to never let go of the one that we've just been to until we've grasped the one that we are moving towards. Because what the sense of self needs above all else is the assurance of its own stability, of its own posture, of its own knowing. And a question does just the opposite of that. It pulls the rug out from under that. Now, somebody came up to me not too long ago and said, why don't you teach investigation more? And I was dumbfounded. Because for me, that is all I've been teaching here. What do we think of the homework it does? The homework should create the movement. It should unfreeze us, unfix us. It should get us go so that there is a moment of insecurity within the homework. I don't know where this is going. You see, you don't know where it's going. I don't know where this is going. It could go anywhere. What do we think we're doing in the discussion groups, in the dyads? When I give you the question, what is true? Is this true? What is this? That's the factor of investigation. It's all I teach people, because I know it to be essential, especially, again, to lay people. And just keeping in this, you can see how each factor reinforces the next, how mindfulness, the awareness, the lights turn on. Now, the investigation rushes forth. What's the next one that we'll talk about after that? Is the energy, the energetic, the interest from when that investigation arises within the mindfulness. The interest becomes fascinating. Joy. We'll never know more joy than the joy of self-discovery. There's no joy that compares to the joy of self-discovery. So if our practice is waning, if it feels lethargic, it's because our life is intruding upon basic fundamental questions that our heart depends upon. And when our life intrudes, it intrudes in terms of safety, in terms of its pursuit, in terms of its ambition, in terms of its neediness, in terms of its own agenda. And that will always undermine the question that is your life. And we will use the security of the pursuit to undermine that question every time. Because which is more safe? Which provides me an assured future? Why would we even go this way? Why would we even want to light this fire? Why not stay at home and go to work every day? As somebody came up to me in the beginning group after the class and started talking about his job and how terrible it was and how he wanted me to help him bring mindfulness to his job. And I said, well, there's a better question. Not how to bring mindfulness to the job, but is this job serving you? What's it doing for you? He didn't want to hear that because he wanted to find his spirituality in something that wasn't working, rather than to ask a pertinent question that would potentially threaten his financial and familial security. But those are the questions. This is where faith comes in. There's an element in which I'm reluctant to say this because there's an element of faith in which with the arising of that kind of passionate energy and need to discover that question, that investigation, that the universe responds, that it meets you. How could that not be? Because it's only our assumption of separation that has distanced us from the universe at all. And when that rising passion is there, the assumption gets very thin. In fact, that's where the question is moving, towards the elimination of that assumption. And so when the veil gets that thin, the universe, you have more access to. Don't apply a formula to your practice. I hear it endlessly in this tradition. It requires something more from you, something richer, something more authentic, something more unique. Something more your own. The Buddha, when he ventures out from his castle walls, he lights upon certain situations of death and dying and old age and crippled people. He sees life. He goes back passionate, on fire with a question. And his whole teaching is a pointing towards further questioning, not towards resolution. Look at the intricate qualities of his teaching, where he didn't just say, well, death and dying, now I'll just note when I'm aging eight. No, he wanted to know what was behind that, where the mind was fixating itself, and how it was fixating itself that made death and aging a problem. He went further. He looked into everything. All of his teaching is just a tremendous exercise in investigation. What we do is we go to the end results, what he discovered, and then we try to rest on what he... Oh, Four Noble Truths, okay, so... But the whole point wasn't that. I think his teaching was an example of how to be, not a resolution of what to see. It was an invitation to come forth. Okay, I saw it now. See it. You see it. But when you see it, it's not my teaching anymore. So what is suffering? What is it? Why is it that I suffer? I don't give a damn what the Buddha said. I'm on fire with my own intentionality. And I hurt. See, now we're seeing old age, death, and dying. We've gone out of the walls, the safe harbor, which is metaphorical. I got to know what's going on that creates this schism, this separation, this isolation, this loneliness, this desperation. Not just wallowing in it, which is where we mostly go. Not blaming or self-indulging, self-blaming, or just despairing, but investigation. Investigation, said the Buddha. That's your way out. That's our way out. So I want to talk about, quickly, because I've overextended myself a little bit, some qualities of an investigation, of what investigation offers. The first is, I've spoken about a little bit, is it allows us to look at the assumptions we based our life upon. Look at the assumptions we based our life upon. The assumption of separation. The assumption that your story is true. We get up every day and we just follow the dictates of the story, and the story has all the multiple factors of agony and misery. Is this story true? We don't question the storyteller, let alone whether the story is true. Never mind that the assumptions are based upon a false fact that there is someone there. Once that fact is established and never investigated, then we have life as we have lived it. And we try to, because that's a fact we do not want to go near. It's too scary to go near that fact. So I'll play out the storyline of the assumption of that fact, and I'll investigate some of the storyline. Like, how come I'm so angry all the time? Why am I so miserable? Not looking at the assumption, the fixation, the posture. Because that would not only disturb the story, it would disturb everything. And our whole world view, our whole life is set up around the central validation, continued validation of that point. So we question from habit, from conditioning, from what we don't like or what we do. I don't like authority, so I'll question authority. Never mind questioning who is it that's questioning authority. We question from a preconceived idea of what we will find, and then we find the preconception, because that's how the mind works. It creates the image of what you pursue. And so we keep finding our and validating our strategy. So let's know, what is this? See, what is this? There's in Pali, investigation is one aspect of this investigation is called Dhamma Vichaya. And it's like sorting things out. What's serving me here? What's working for me? What's going on? You notice when you do a certain thing that you don't feel good. Like when you gather around complainers and everybody is lost in a kind of heaviness of complaint. It doesn't feel good. But never mind, everybody's doing it, so I'll just keep complaining. And finding myself in that circle of people who complain. And there's a sense of me being validated. The complainer is validated when I get other people around that share that view of the world. And so, but Dhamma Vichaya is, let's sort this out. What's helpful and what isn't? What's working for me and what's not? And you begin to feel the after effects of complaint. This isn't very helpful. This isn't uplifting. This isn't allowing my stretch, my energy. It isn't moving in the right direction. And you start picking out people who move you in the right direction. You don't get lost in the security of a partner who has a negative energetically. I can't do this. Is a waste of time here. Life is too precious for this. And you start looking for people. And you start seeing what when I watch TV and I see something violent and you feel this afterglow of agitation after you. Is that helpful? What is that? What's going on here? Not just the assumption that, well, you know, it was a good program and it really shows, you know, it's like, what is this thing doing to me? What is it doing to me? That's what we're trying to do here, is to bring forth, instill. How are we going to break out of this thing until we see it? And the mind it doesn't have resources to bring in the energy and interest to see it, except through a question. Have you noticed you sit in, you get up in the morning or before you go to bed and you just sit there and you just don't have the energy to really look. You know, you're tired and the whole thing is just, we're just entrapped in this cocoon. And there's no arousing of any curiosity within that cocoon. Not even a question of, what is this? What's going on in this? Why is it that I'm feeling so... See, what is it that's... What state of mind is holding this together? We just make the assumption that this is, well, at the end of the day, this is how I feel. It just takes one question to burst the bubble of that cocoon. It also shows patterns of dependency. We investigate patterns of dependency. Shows us where we're dependent upon things. Krishnamurti, a noted spiritual teacher, said, the mind that conforms can never be in a state of discovery. Where we're dependent, where we feel our life needs to be, needs to conform to a particular experience or needs to depend upon it. I see this much more often than I've ever seen it before in terms of intensity. We're getting more and more, our vitality is dependent upon intensity for us to have any kind of life in our eyes. And it can show itself in terms of keeping a lot of stimulation going through various sense doors. Or it can show itself in terms of drama, keeping drama in our life, and that we don't feel alive unless there's a drama that's going on. Who wants a life like that? Just ask yourself if you're going to die with drama in your life. Are you going to die with a radio, an iPod in your ear? You see? I mean, how are we going to wake up if we're dependent upon certain conditions for the sake of our aliveness? That we can't live without something coming in to stir us sufficiently so that our wakefulness can gather its a sufficient steam so that I can open my eyes. And that when that level of intensity and stimulation falls to a certain level, well, then despair comes in. And I feel cut off and despondent because I prop myself up from the array of tools I have on my belt, the cell phones, the Palm Pilots, and Blackberries. I was with a young Westerner many years ago when I was in the forests of Thailand, and he was a Tibetan monk, and he was just spending the rains retreat in the monastery, and he had just come from southern India where many of the Tibetan refugees had been sent, and he was telling me about his life, and he was just doing what the rest of the Tibetan monks in that location were doing. They were planting their fields and living very simple lives as farmers. And I said, well, how did you stay alive in that? And he said, well, we would be planting corn or whatever they were planting, and we would be doing Dharma combat between the rows of corn. And we would say, and what is the emptiness that you're feeling now? And we would just be going at each other all day long. just as an example of how our Dharma life can be. Because the joy of that, suddenly you're not planting corn anymore. You're taking on emptiness. You're taking on the very essence of life. And whatever we're doing is no longer mundane because we've uplifted the whole scene, the whole environment, to hold that intensity of interest and joy of participating in it fully through investigation. Now, will you do it? I don't know. But from my point of view, your spiritual life depends on it. The last thing I want to do is pick up the homework sheet, right? Many of you don't. Many of you don't come to the discussion groups because it's extra. And what happens to your aliveness in that intervening week? What, does this sustain you? Contact high? Are we going to wake up? Because I'm really not interested in putting us all to sleep and fall, you know, just kind of cruising through 20 more years, collecting my Donna. I want to show that this can work. And I want the experiment to start here. That I haven't wasted my Dharma teaching, where I should be off teaching retreat people because they're the ones that really have it together. If I believed that, that's where I would be. If I believed that you needed to be there, that's where I would be for your awakening. If I thought that there was one more hopeful opportunity in that environment as opposed to this one, that's where I would be. I just have to get you sufficiently attuned to the fact that that's the truth for you as well as for me. Not to look away from your life one iota, but to look fully into it. Wherever it's going to take me, I will ask the important question. I don't care where it's going to take me. It doesn't matter where it's going to take you, because it will take you into the unknown. The question has to take you into the unknown. Every question will take you into the unknown. Where do we think this venture is going to take us? And the easiest way to get there is to ask yourself a question, because you don't know the answer. There you are in the unknown. Where do all the Dharma talks point? It's as close to us as the question that's the most relevant to us. What is this? And then there's a sudden stop, a sudden stopping. No longer is the intellect in rule. No. There's just the light. Just the light's on now. An intense, keen interest in the most difficult thing that I could ever ask myself. We're between the bars of the jungle gym. We don't know where this is going to go. No guarantees. No formula. No formula. Now we are in the state of wakefulness and need not go anywhere. Now you know what aliveness is. For we have become the question. Thank you. Any questions? Do we have some? Yes. I know. Okay, the question is about analysis. He heard that when you sit in meditation, the instructions were always just don't analyze, just be present to. And now it sounds as if I'm bringing in analysis. First of all, there is a system to investigation. I'm glad you asked that question. Let me talk. It was part of the talk, but the pages got all. Anyway, so there's a system to it. The first thing is you don't want too much intellectual stirring. That's not investigation. So to be able to sit and quiet the mind on the breath so that there is a quieting and a focus, the questions cannot come from a discursive mind, a mind that is chattering to itself and is just, because you're exactly right. An investigation from discursiveness will be just thinking. You'll just think. That's not what this is about at all. First, we have to focus in and allow our mind to quiet. Now, that may not happen on the cushion because there's not enough reactivity that might be occurring on the cushion. There's quite likely more reactivity that's going to occur off the cushion. So as we begin to be balanced in our ability to focus off the cushion as well, then we start connecting with where it is that we're reacting. And a perfect door for investigation to begin is where we're reacting. We don't analyze, not if analysis means to you that you're thinking about what it is that's going on. Rather, it is the direct seeing. It's the direct seeing of what it is that's going on. And when you're reacting, there is two things that's going on. There's that which is occurring, and there's my reaction to that which is occurring. And you begin to see directly experience the second. You can see both of them. You can see what's occurring, and you can see the pullback from what's occurring. Right? And then that's the inroad to beginning to see beyond just the given of the light being turned. Okay, so what's going on there? Now, you might ask yourself a verbal question that might arise as the mind gets quieter and more focused without thought. Quite likely there will be a verbal thought that comes to your mind. What's going on there? Like that. But it calls you to even greater quiet, not to more thinking. So the method of investigation is to move to more and more quiet, more and more subtle seeing, more and more sensitivity, so that you can see the nuances of what's occurring, rather than just say, oh, I know I'm in pain and I'm reacting. And the whitewash effect of what the mind wants to do. Awareness wants to go in there and actually live the experience. It cannot do that if it's trying to get rid of or over the reaction. It's not about getting over the reaction or ending the reaction even. It's about being interested in the reaction to see what's going on. So you're inviting awareness in to explore and to understand rather than to judge and opinionate. The mind wants to opinionate. So I'm reacting again. I've got to get over that reaction. It wants to summarize. But awareness just wants to behold. It just wants to take part. It wants to understand. It wants to see. And the only way it can do that is if we extract all judgment from the mind that is being quiet and being intruding into these somewhat sacred places that we haven't gone before. Now, most of that will likely come off the cushion. Sometimes a question of the heart arises that becomes a passion in and of itself. Like, and I've used these questions before. Where is there love in this moment? Where is there joy in this moment? I feel so dry and distant. I keep hearing these words and get a sense of how joy can be accessed, but it feels inaccessible right now. Where is there joy in this moment? Where is there love in this moment? Where is there contentment in this moment? And you move, not with a ridicule of the moment for it not having contentment, joy, or love, but to see whether we're framing the moment in such a way through our responses and reactions that it prohibits or limits or obscures that very love, contentment, or joy. And so I have to listen below the level of the obscuration in order to reconnect with the contentment and joy that must be present in this moment. You see, it calls forth something more from us than just a blanket, okay, I can be aware. Can we? Awareness, when it comes out, is usually very coarse, very rough, very gross. It's not nuanced. Our questions call forth the nuance. It makes, as I mentioned this before, it makes the water of our attention wetter so that it soaks in and gets into the areas that are where there are subtle judgments and postures occurring. There's much more I can say about it, but go to the homework and be sincere with the homework. And then let's discuss it next week about how this can be helpful to us. And if I don't understand it, please bring it forward. Because I want everyone to get this. Now we have to stop.